Session number 9483, Reel 8.
Mr. Templar, Reel 8.
Yes. However, powers that be had taken precautions against such an event by employing using the RE, our Royal Engineers, to, I think, use wire rope to make sure the damn thing didn't fall, and so averted disaster in the minds of all the French inhabitants. So, including ourselves, we didn't want it to happen like that. However, we got to this position east of Elbeur in the late afternoon of the 20th of March, 1918.
Hang on a moment.
Stop it then.
No, you'd started the march in... I understood that you'd left your previous posting...
January 1918. Yes, well, we'd been in other things, and on that occasion we arrived after many days of marching down near Elba, which was miles away.
Right.
I can't remember how many days it took us, and I can't remember when we started, but we arrived on the 20th of March at that position. See, and we found a camp of bell tents waiting for us, and we went into those for the night and went to sleep. The following morning at dawn, although we were, I suppose, 25 or so kilometres away, probably 30, I don't know, from the actual front, we were woken from sleep by the noise of a barrage. A terrific barrage, and that was in the morning of the 21st of March 1918, and apparently the Germans had launched a very heavy attack at dawn that morning. Within a matter of minutes of hearing all this, orders were called, you know, and we were told to get breakfast and be ready to move off in full marching order within half an hour. And we marched the whole of that day with a 10-minute halt each hour, as usual, until we came within shelling distance of the line, as it was then. And that was about nightfall, and we were put into huts. Sort of big Nissen huts, and in our various companies, and during the night, when we were all asleep, Jerry started shelling the area, and he hit the hut which contained most of the C Company men, and caused a lot of casualties there. So that after that, we were more or less awake, and. Immediately it was light enough, we were instructed to discard our large packs and dress in number one fighting order, that is, haversack on the back with the mess tin on the back, and you had your various bits and pieces like entrenching tools, but you had your rifle and bayonet. You were in number one fighting kit, which was lighter than using the valise, and we went into action that morning at dawn, and it lasted most of the day. We were signalled, there was no telephone because no lines, and the colonel was in charge of the operation, and the signallers had to carry messages to and from the companies wherever they might be. And it was very, very hectic. because although there was shell fire and that sort of thing happening, messages had to be taken or brought back. Brought back was very important because the colonel had to be kept made aware of where the companies were. And pretty well all the signal section were acting as runners then. There was a signal officer, but he had nothing much to do at that moment. He was a new one. He wasn't the original signal officer. And so that went on for the whole of that night. I was... all of my chaps had been given messages to take, and at one time I was the only signaller left with the colonel for taking messages, and he called me and he said, "Oh, well, you know," gave me a message, I forget which company it was, to go to, and I had to go. But as I'd got to go and I was the last signaller available, I went to the signal officer before starting off and asked him to keep an eye open for the section as they returned to headquarters and see if they were all right. And he said, "That's all right," and I went off. I went wherever it was necessary for me to deliver the message, you know, a little bit of ducking and diving here and there. And I eventually found the officer concerned, and he gave me a reply to take back to the colonel. And I left them and got back, and then by the time I got back, there was several of the signallers back, including John, and several of the others were all back available. And that went on and off until about dawn.
Were you in trenches at this time?
No, we weren't. There were no trenches.
Just open country?
No, it was open, and it was moving forward, and the Germans were on the attack, and they were driving me... driving beyond trenches and into open country. They were driving for Soissons or Albert, where we'd been the previous day, you see.
Do you recall the name of the place where you were?
No, not at the moment. I couldn't tell you. You were under battle conditions then. You weren't being pussyfooted, you know. They weren't chucking sponges at you. Anyway, about dawn, the then signal officer called me and said, "Get the men together, we're moving out." So I said, "What do you mean moving out?" And he said, "Well, I have instructions to withdraw." So he withdrew us and he led the way. And I had all the signals under my eye and I made them all follow along, and I looked out for any possible stragglers, because you always get men who are a bit exhausted or something like that, and I kept the rear of the line of, you know, this sort of little column, and the men were obviously tired out anyway. And I kept an eye on them. There was one who was causing me a bit of trouble, and he was a bit of a not very strong youngster, and I said, "Well, go on, bloody well get going, or else I'd have to kick your backside," sort of thing, and that's where I got them along. And we kept going until, oh, sometime, I forget which now, and we got to a point where we'd been attacked once or twice. There'd been one or two skirmishes. We were attacked by aircraft, German aircraft, and we were running short of small arms ammunition, you know, the 303 cartridges. And we'd stopped. And the men came to me and said, "We're getting short of ammo." And then I went over to the signal officer and I said, "We're short of ammunition, what are we going to do?" And the man nearby said, "Well, I noticed a dump concealed of small arms ammunition, little boxes of it, about that length, full of cartridges in clips."
About 3 feet long?
Hmm?
About 3 feet long, boxes?
Well, a couple of feet long, you know, because they're heavy, you see. And they had rope handles. So I said to the officer, "What shall I do? This Brad says there's some about 150 yards back." I didn't notice any myself, but he evidently spotted some. So I said, "Shall I take a man or a couple of men and bring some boxes along?" He said, "No, you stay with the men. I will take one man and we'll go and get as many as we can carry." So I was ordered to stay with the men. Anyway, he and one of the other men went together, and I was getting a bit disturbed because I got the men under cover. You know, got them in because there was no trench or anything like that. It was just rough ground with a lot of grass and that sort of thing about. So I spread them out, you see, and looking to the east where we might expect attack, and just to be ready with what cartridges you've got. And eventually I was getting rather disturbed because the officer and the man were taking a long time, and I was tossing up in my mind what I should do, because I had no idea what the officer's orders were, what he was told to do. He hadn't told me anything about what he was told to do. And I just did nothing because I kept the man under cover and alert. So this bloke turned up. He was absolutely loaded, because the cartridges, when you took them out of those boxes, were in bandoliers. I forget how many, 100 or 200 cartridges of bandolier, something like that. Anyway, he'd had to carry them all back himself. I said, well, where's Lieutenant, whatever his name was? And he said, well, he got himself captured, Sarge. I said, what do you mean, got himself captured? And he said, he helped me get the boxes open, and then he said, load yourself up and get back to the sergeant, because I'm going to stop here. And he sat down on one of the boxes and lit a cigarette and waited for Jerry to pick him up. And they were coming over that bit of terrain then. Well, this fellow got enough to supply our needs for ammunition, at any rate, enough for the next day or two. And I dished them out. And as I dished them out, I was looking around to the area to see where I could move them, because I didn't like where I was. And a German plane came over. He'd obviously been taken in. Whether anything had been said about a group without an officer, but this plane was definitely after us, and he was firing a machine gun at us, because it was those days either the occupant of the pilot or someone with him would be firing a machine gun out of one of the side windows of the plane, you see, and we were firing back at them with our rifles. And all of a sudden the German came right along where this line was. It was pretty obvious because we were all firing at him, and he circled around to come back in again. And so I yelled to the men, hold your fire, he's coming back in again. When he comes back in, aim at his nose and fire when I shout, so that we all fire together. And he came in, and I came in. I was lying on the ground there with my sights on him, and when he came in into my sights, I yelled fire, and everyone fired simultaneously. And instead of him shooting at us, he wobbled a bit, went over the top of us, a little bit of a slope there was, and he dropped down where the Germans were, and smoke went up. We got him. And the men, a lot of men hadn't been under my control before. I was just a signal sergeant, you see. And they all bloody well cheered. And after that, I could do as I liked. Now, whatever I said, that was it. There was no argument about it. They got confident. And that's how I got them away. We went and found a spot with a that looked possible. And one flank of the line was resting on a tributary of the Somme, which I think it was called Bray-sur-Somme. And we formed along a little embankment where a little bit of digging got us a bit of cover, and we decided to wait there and see what happened. And then later that day or afternoon, one of the divisional commanders, red, you know, they had red tabs on them, red round their hat, found us, and he came up to me and he said, "Are you the senior NCO?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, look, I know you haven't got an officer. I heard there was somebody, a group of Glossers who hadn't got an officer." I don't know how he'd heard, unless they'd been in communication with the Germans, and that's not an impossibility. You know, we're reporting the capture of an officer, you see. And
so the normal procedure would be that they would inform the opposing side of an officer had been...
I don't know what they would do about that, but the point was I knew nothing about it. And this staff captain or major or whatever rank he was looked at where I placed the men and he said, "That's not too bad, but I'm going to shift some of your men into another post." And he made one or two adjustments. And he said, "I'm going to try and get an officer to come up and take command of you at dawn tomorrow." So they took, he took Corporal Ayton, the one who'd been deposed a few weeks before, and standing next to near him was one or two more, including John, my pal, and they carted that lot off and put them on a post nearby.
About how many of you were there?
Between 30 and 40 or something like that. Quite a little group, you see. It might have been more, I don't know. I didn't count them, bloody thing. However, he carted John and Corporal Ayton away and put them on a separate post, and he said, "I'll get an officer up to you at dawn." So, but during the night, having been on the march and having been, you know, under considerable activity, sometimes not bad and sometimes unwelcome, our water bottles had got empty. We hadn't got any rations, you see. And we were existing on hardtack and water. And we had to get the water bottles refilled. Well, as some of our chaps were on the banks of the River Bray, I started the system of passing water bottles along our line for them to fill out of the river, whatever the sort of stuff it was water. And they were being passed back again, and all of a sudden, it was dark, they were being fired on by a German group that had just arrived in a position near us. And we fired back at their flashes. And it sort of became a stalemate for the rest of the night. And I was on the alert all the time. In fact, I didn't get any sleep for more than 2 or 3 days. And then, just about dawn, a strange officer arrived and he spotted me and he came up and he said, "Are you senior NCO?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I've been sent over to take command." I said, "Well, sir, I don't know you." He said, we both know that makes no difference." He said, "Where are the Germans?" I said, "They're just over there. A matter of 20 yards or so. Maybe just that sort of thing, where those houses are over the road, you know, or somewhere like that." And he said, "What are they going to do?" I said, "I don't know, sir." "Oh, don't you? All right, take a couple of men and go out on patrol. Get as near as you can to them. Find out how many there are." Very good. So there was a white mist then, because it had been hot during the day, cold night, and a white mist, which was fortunate for me. So I got a couple of my chaps there, and I said, "Look, before we went out, I said, I'm going to take you down. I've got to go on patrol. You heard what the instructions were. Now, I'm going to drop one of you at a time, and I'll point out when I want you to go down. I want you to lay flat and look carefully and watch. Don't shoot me, because I should go on after I've dropped you two. Probably I should go on alone, because they're not far away." So they knew what I'd wanted him to do, so we started off, crept along in the mist, and all of a sudden I felt that I was getting a bit close to the Germans, so I pointed to one man and he dropped down quietly and spread himself out and got his rifle ready a little bit farther. The other one dropped down at indication, and I went on alone. I came to a little dip. I remember this very distinctly, and it was a little like a little had been a gully or a ditch. The Germans were just behind that, and they put up a bit of wire, and they got some sort of bit of earth there as well. And so I started to crawl down the little slope that it was. I had my rifle, I'd held it about the point of balance, you know, the usual spot, with my right hand holding the grip at the stop, my finger on the trigger, and I was crawling along on my elbow and belly. The rifle well forward. And suddenly the mist shifted, and there were, next thing I knew, there was a bloody square-headed German looking about for me, or, you know, couldn't see me. I was right low. And then I got him lined up with my rifle, and I almost pressed the trigger. And I thought, Christ, that's silly. He's got some more with him, so I should probably get punctured. So I could see he wasn't looking at me, he was looking over me. He didn't think of looking down.
How close to you was he?
Oh, I could have spat at him. You know, I would say probably where that wall was.
So no, no.
And I was lying low on a bit of a slope.
No more than 8 or 10 feet?
No, something like that. And so I realised that he was looking over me for something in the mist. So I decided not to pull the trigger, and I sort of started to move my feet backwards and started gradually to withdraw myself. And just then the mist closed in again, so I jumped up and ran, and I waved to the two blokes, bloody well get in sort of thing. And I dropped down behind a heap of stones that somebody had thoughtfully provided for my cover. Just a little heap of stones, no higher than that bloody thing from the bottom of the fireplace.
Just about a foot, I'll say.
What?
It's just about a foot.
Oh, listen, yes, just about a foot of stone. It had been raked together for me to drop behind. Other people had got selected spots, were nice and cosy, including the officer who was in a little bit of a ditch. So I dropped down there, and I kept my eyes open for the Germans, and there were five of them came out, and they started firing. So I dropped down behind this little heap of stones, and suddenly I saw a head move in the mist, just a slight movement. I got my sights on it, and I went, pulled the trigger, or rather pressed it. And then I opened my eyes and looked along the sights, and I'd got him all right, bang in the head, I expect. And then that was that, and then a second one made a movement, and I thought, hey, he looks like he's going to shoot at me. So I got my sights on him and pressed it, and that was it for him. And then there was a German nearby, who obviously got excited, jumped up. I think he might have had a telephone line that he wanted to get back to. They'd probably come up on a reel, you see. And the officer jumped up and started to run back to their position. And the officer started shouting, shoot him, somebody, shoot him, somebody. And when you're under those tense conditions, your voice goes very deep. And I remember growling, shut up. And I got my sights on this running German. I aimed, I saw the buttons of his tunic, and I moved my hand a fraction just to catch him right, and bang, and that was it. He jumped up in the air and went down flat. And there were still two more having to go at me. So, I had to sort of retire. I got up on my elbows a little bit too high for that one. And I dropped down behind the little bit of stone. And I saw another one. And I leveled up and pulled the trigger, and that was number four. And then there was still one. I couldn't find him, so I laid down flat on my face, pulled my tin hat so it was down over my eyes, because I knew that I'd got to be careful, just so I could just see my sights, and brought my rifle gently up, and I spotted the movement, and I got my sights on him, pressed the trigger, and intended to check my aim. Instead of that, my rifle went up in the air, and I was blinded. Exploded bullet, and the metal of my backside protector on the right hand side of my rifle in line with my eye. Thing about less than an eighth of an inch thick, about 3/4 of an inch deep, and that was blown away. And the bullet had burst, actually. Now my face, eyes, were bunged up with splinters, and not one of them touched the optic nerve.
So your gun had exploded?
What?
Your gun had exploded?
No, it was a German bullet that had hit it.
I see.
We were so close. If it hadn't been for my backsight protector, it would have gone straight into my eye. And I'd have been a goner then. Well, I was a bit flabbergasted, you know. I couldn't open my eyes, I couldn't see, and I thought, Christ, my parents are going to need my help. And what about days? I shan't know anything about Earth. That's if I get a bayonet through my guts. So I laid still, groped around, found a piece of rag, and eventually managed to wipe my eyes carefully, and I got them open again, and I could see. I looked at my left hand, and that was a mess, well, the explosion. I looked at my right hand, that wasn't too happy, but it was not as bad as the left. And I looked at my rifle, and that was the backsight protector had blown away, of course. And the stock of the rifle was split from the band, that is the band where the sling started, and it had split the wood of that right the way down to the magazine. But it hadn't killed me.
So the rifle had really taken all the damage from the bullet, hadn't it?
That's right, and I'd been fortunate in not being blinded. So I lay a bit quietly to recover myself, and one of my chaps who was near me, he sensed that I'd moved, and he said something. I said, "What did you say?" He said, "I thought you'd gone, Sarge." I said, "Well, I haven't. What happened to that German?" He said, "Well, you blew his bloody head off." And that was it. The officer called over afterwards, and he said, "I got a bit of your splinter here," and he got a little tiny pinprick in his cheek, where one of the splinters had gone into his cheek. That was off my rifle, or the German bullet, I don't know which. So then he said, "Well," he's laid there, and he said, "Well, you better get the men up that bank." We had a bank behind us about 25 or 30 feet high, I suppose. About the height of the brick walls around here. And I ordered them to get up there. I didn't know whether there were any more Germans coming up. I said, "Go up in twos and threes. And the officer and I will stay here and follow you when you're all up." So they all cleared up, except for John and Billy Ayton, you know, the ex-sergeant or corporal as he was now. So that was the story there. We got away. And then after that, I got the men up this bank. When we got up there, it was a little bit of a copse, and you had no field of fire. You had no vision from it. It was an untenable position, and it could have been outflanked easily. So I looked round myself, and then I suddenly realised the officer was looking round, and he said, take a man and go down on the left and see what's happening. One man. Well, one of the chaps who'd been on patrol with me, he jumped forward when he heard that, and he went down ahead of me, down this slope. I followed, and then instead of him waiting for me, he started to run, and I realised that he'd panicked. So I yelled to him, "Wait, don't go on." But he took no notice, and he kept on running. He ran to the spot just about where Corporal Ayton and John group was. I knew the Germans.